You've heard the headlines. Get some perspective now with Bruce St. James and Pamela Hughes.
Good morning to you and happy Wednesday. The cry in the immigration debacle has been Congress needs to do something. Well, congressmen are talking about doing something.
The lead.
Yeah, like you said, everyone agrees Congress needs to act when it comes to the amount of immigrants from Central America being apprehended along the southern border. So Senator Lindsey Graham has come up with a plan. In it, he's proposing legislation that would stop asylum applications at the border and would allow families to be held for 100 days.
So there is at least, and there are, to be fair, there are competing plans, different ideas, but Senator Lindsey Graham has come forward with one, and it has some specifics in it.
Yes, it does. So it's not just one of these blanket statements of Congress needs to act, and we're working
something.
On it's not we need to do something. Okay. Oh, frump. No, this actually has some plans, some teeth to it. Uh-huh. What are those teeth? Take a listen.
In the future, you can apply for an asylum from Central America, but you have to do so in an American consulate or embassy in your home country. And we're going to try to set up a facility in Mexico. No more asylum claims at the U.S. border if you're from Central America.
Okay. And that, to be clear, this is a proposal that will require changing U.S. law.
Yeah. Listen, I get the plan. I like that aspect of it. I honestly do. But the practicality of it?
With the practicality of what? It passing Congress or the practicality of people obeying it?
Well, I think the practicality of those who are truly seeking asylum, of which I understand it is nowhere near the number of people that are showing up along our southern border. But if you are in fear for your life, right, because of persecution, we hear a lot of like gangs in Honduras,
gang violence,
in El Salvador. Yeah, things along those lines. And your life has been threatened or your child's life has been threatened. Is the best option for you applying for asylum and staying in that country?
In your home country. You're afraid of living in your home country.
So that would be.
You have a twofold reason. You want to get away from the place and you want to find a safe place to go.
Now, I mean, so that's a problem.
I've thought of it like that.
That's a problem for those that are truly seeking asylum. Uh-huh. For everyone else who just wants to come to this country, you know, because America's great, then that might kind of cut that off at the pass, so
but
to speak.
The first point you made, I think, is really important. So if you have a credible asylum claim, credible, and we don't know, is it 5%, 10%, 30%, whatever it is, of the people that are coming to the border. And that asylum claim is based on what you believe is a direct threat to your life. And let's say a judge agrees. We know that it takes years to get to that point for the even to get in front of the judge.
Yeah.
So if you had a credible asylum claim in, I'm going to use Guatemala as an example, would you stick around Guatemala for a couple of years till the U.S. government gets around to granting your asylum, hoping they don't kill you in the meantime?
Yeah, that's one of my questions about that.
I hadn't thought of it like practical like that.
Yeah, that's what I meant, the practicality of it. But here's the other prong to Lindsey Graham's approach.
If you're an unaccompanied minor, we're going to change the law to allow the minor to be sent back to their home country in a safe and secure fashion as if the minor child was from Mexico or Canada.
Mm. I don't really have a problem with that either. I mean,
holding kids longer.
No. This is sending them home.
Sending them home.
Yeah, this is sending them home. We do it in Mexico. We do it in Canada. Why couldn't you do it with Central America? But the holding period, yeah, that is something else that he's looking to change.
Instead of having 20 days to process a family with a minor child, we're going to increase it to 100 days so that the family can be detained humanely. And we can get the claim processed and not have to release them into the country.
I don't know how much support this would have.
Really?
I don't know how far it would get.
Why?
Because I think that you're going to have people. And by the way, this doesn't have like universal Republican support. So we haven't even got around to whether the Democrats would,
we'll
agree
that
with
later,
it.
Yeah.
Making it harder for people with a legitimate claim to escape violence or escape with their lives, I think is going to be a non-starter for some people.
Here's the problem, though, Bruce. So many people that are coming to the border don't have a legitimate claim.
You say that. The latest numbers are 80% of the women from El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, and or Mexico who have been screened at the U.S. border were, quote, found to have a significant possibility of establishing eligibility for asylum or protection under the Convention Against Torture, the U.S. asylum laws.
But of those, so 80% of those...
They passed the initial screening.
Okay, then when you actually get to the who gets asylum in this country, the numbers are...
Less than that.
20 to 30%.
Agreed. So the problem is, are you going to be the one that sends the legitimate ones back to be killed?
You know, or are you going to be the one that allows everybody to come into the United States? Yeah. You see, like, this is a
difficult... count me as one. I do not want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. I want those with legitimate claims to have an opportunity to do it. We have a process to get to the legitimate claims, and I'm not comfortable sending them back to their country to be killed while they wait.
Okay, so are you then okay with them being held longer? So that maybe, like, the screening... Because we know... Hold on a second. Let me finish. Yeah. We know that a lot of individuals who are crossing the border... We heard this in Yuma, and that's why they've declared this emergency down there. They're just being released into the public. They're not even having a hearing. There's nowhere to hold them. Mm-hmm. And then we know that the number of judges down on the border is a huge problem. And that is also something that Lindsey Graham is trying to take hold of.
We're going to hire 500 new immigration judges to deal with a 900,000 person asylum backlog, to clear the backlog.
I don't know if 500 is the number. Whatever the number is.
It's better than nothing.
More judges to rapidly, I use the term weed through, and I know that sounds kind of disparaging, to get through the asylum claims to find out who has legitimate ones. I want as many judges as it takes to speed that process up.
I like individuals applying for asylum in their home country. I fear that those that are afraid for their lives, that's going to put them in a very difficult predicament. I like sending minors right back home, as we do with Canada and Mexico, increasing the holding period from, what is it, 20 days?
To 100.
To 100.
Flores settlement says 20.
I like that. I do. You have to change the law for it. So I understand that there's an obstacle there. Hiring more judges. I like that. I like a lot of what Lindsey Graham is saying in it. The other thing I like that he's saying is this.
I'm willing to put other immigration ideas on the table to marry up with this. But what I'm not willing to do is to ignore this problem any longer.
Good. What I just heard there is we're going to do something here.
Willing to compromise.
And here's what I want to do. But if you don't like what I want to do, then you got to start coming to the table with some solutions of your own.
That's fair.
Because I'm going to entertain them. What I'm not going to entertain is the status quo of just allowing what's happening on the border to continue. So I don't agree with Lindsey Graham on a lot of things, but on this, I'm glad that he's taking that first step forward. We'll see what comes of it.
Yeah. We talked about this last week, that Jared Kushner, the guy in charge of Middle East peace, government reform,
Israeli relations.
Israel. The economy. No. Also had a plan for immigration.
Yeah.
He went before a group of Republican senators, just the Republican senators, to talk about it. And apparently it didn't go over very well.
Yeah. You know what? It was like this luncheon that, you know, hey, guys,
let's
here's
get
what
together.
We're thinking of.
Have
yeah.
A
you know, and here are my ideas. Well, the senators who were actually dealing with this problem had a lot of questions about his proposal, and he wasn't really capable of answering those questions. He wasn't able to further his plan and address their concerns. So while he was going in with his one idea, a lot of the senators left that luncheon. Republican senators left that luncheon going, we don't get this, scratching their heads.
Apparently they asked questions about maybe specificity. They wanted to understand some of this, and Mr. Kushner did not have any answers to it or had no solutions to their issues. So it appears that Jared Kushner's plan to fix immigration has reached a roadblock with Republican senators.
Well, they don't think he really understands the issue. So that might be
Maybe he was busy with Middle East peace that day.
This might be his plan, but you would need a senator or somebody to take on this legislation and try to make it happen, and nobody seems to be willing to do so. Hence the reason why I think you have Lindsey Graham talking today.
Yeah. I can argue. I can see Lindsey Graham's is a starting point. Will it go anywhere? I still get back to, and I'm not proud to say it, that there is a benefit on both sides to not solve this problem. There is a benefit on both sides to use it as a talking point to beat the other side up, and that compromise is still a four-letter word in Washington, D.C. So I don't. While we can agree on certain points of it, sound smart, I don't know if Lindsey Graham's proposal will move very far. But we will find out, see how serious people are about it. So when you think about the military and serving in the military, if I asked you what percentage of military age people are ineligible to serve in the military for a variety of reasons, what do you think? 20%? The number is much higher. We'll tell you how many young people can't serve in our military and why.
Bruce St. James and Pamela Hughes.
I've heard the story before about military service, and while some people think more people should do it, the U.S. military, the Pentagon, says we'd be in a world of trouble if more of these people showed up at our front door. The reason? A lot, and I do mean a lot, of, let's just call them young folks, are completely ineligible for the military, and it has a ripple effect in their ability to get a, quote, job in the public sector.
Yeah,
as well.
We're not just talking about the military. We're talking about getting a career, not just a job, but like a career.
Okay.
So if I were to ask you, how many young people are ineligible for the military right now? I mean, we hear a lot about like obesity.
Okay, you know, they couldn't pass the physical
standards have kind of changed. That's usually what I kind of think of.
Yeah.
What if I told you it was
40%, maybe 30?
More than 70%.
Okay, that's the exact opposite.
More than 70% of young people wouldn't be able to join the military.
70.
The main reasons for this, obesity is one issue. So the physicality that we just talked about is a problem.
Standards they would not be able to meet.
No high school diploma.
Okay, you have to have a high school diploma.
Or having a criminal record.
Wow.
Now, those three things also are having an impact on young people's ability to get a good job and build
out a
career.
Job and trying to get a job in the private sector as well, those things would get in the way. I think it is certainly a sad commentary on where we are at. And I saw we've had in the past, and at the beginning of the Afghanistan and Iraq wars, don't you remember the conversation the military was having about, I'm going to say lowering, I think they called it altering, the physical fitness standards just so they could get people.
Right. Like, and that's where
they had to start looking the other way on certain things, or else guess what? We're not going to have anybody.
And that's why we started hearing about obesity becoming a national security threat to America, right?
That's right. That's right.
But now what we also have is a war for the qualified. You think about that. You've got 30% of young people who are qualified to either go into the military or get a job.
Because they are physically fit on some level, they have no criminal record, and they have at least a high school diploma.
So now you have all these different entities fighting for just that 30%. What do we do about
that? That's the under the age of 24.
Think about that.
I can't believe that. 30% of those under the age of 24 would make that cut.
Now, that's according to Pentagon data. This isn't just some, like, you know, fly-by-night survey.
I went down to high school and played Duck, Duck, Goose and decided they're all a bunch of fatty bumbleaddies.
But there seems to be some sort of disconnect here as well, because there's another report that says about more than half of employers find it really hard to hire people that have the right skills, adequate skills, training and education. So on one hand, we hear that employers are struggling to find
just to fill spots.
We hear that, you know, 70% of young people are ineligible for the military. But yet on the other hand, we hear about how much pressure our young people are under. How much pressure they have to succeed to get the 4.2 GPA I don't know how that happens.
Well, maybe they're just being lied to about that. This parents that just want them to sit around studying books, because apparently if you are even remotely can walk upright, you haven't spent time in prison, and you got through high school, even if you had a 2.8 GPA, you're in demand. Guess what? You've got a chance now, because you're in that small group at the top of the scale already.
But that,
for passing what most of us would say are pretty minimum standards.
But then you have the employers who are saying, you know, less than half have the adequate skills or education. So that kind of goes and flies in the face of that. So for me, there just seems to be this disconnect of, or, you know, is there too much pressure on kids to be overachievers and we're taking away their childhood because we want them to study, study, study? Or is there, you know, so many of these young people today can't keep it together. They're out committing crimes. They're lazy eating bonbons, playing video games. And, oh, yeah, they flunked out of high school.
Something that wasn't mentioned in here that I've heard the military talk about before is drug use.
Okay.
Add that in there.
Yeah.
Regular, daily, weekly use
of
things like
marijuana.
Does that lead
to a criminal record, you know?
Well, and could that, well, is that part of the criminal record? Is possession and things like that. Interesting. The military finding it harder and harder.
Employers.
Well, and they're competing for the same people. They didn't used to have to compete for the exact same people, but there's just fewer and fewer out there that would, we call it, make the cut. Is your constant use of a digital device, think a phone or a tablet or a computer, affecting your brain? And let me guess, it's not affecting it positively. We're talking about that coming up next.
KTAR News on 92.3 FM. Get some perspective. Bruce St. James and Pamela Hughes.
You know, our... is addiction to word? Dependency might be a kinder word on digital technology is just baked in the cake now. Almost every single one of you walks around with a smartphone. You have a tablet at home, or maybe your child, you know, watches Bubble Guppies on one.
I got you turned on to Bubble Guppies.
I'm all
didn't
about
I?
The Bubble Guppies these days. But it is like this huge social experiment that we're not exactly sure how it's going to impact us long term.
Yeah, you say social experiment, and you could make that argument, but it's also an experiment that's being done on our brains.
Right.
And one that we didn't exactly sign up for. Yeah, I know. Okay. No one's forcing you to have that phone in your hand or that tablet in your child's bedroom. But nowadays, it's ubiquitous. We all have one.
Sure.
But what are we doing and how is it impacting us? And here's the deal.
Right.
We don't really know. Because when you
the answer is don't know.
Well, because it hasn't been around long enough.
Right.
When you're looking at like diseases of the brain, they take decades to formulate and come to light for us to understand.
And then to do all the research on it and all the, yeah, exactly. That makes sense.
So at this point in time, there's a risky experiment that is going on with some potentially serious public health consequences that we're not going to know for another decade or two if we're making these mistakes.
What is the average age now that kids get a smartphone? American kids. Average age for a smartphone for a kid.
12,
let's
13?
Go with lower. How about 10?
10.
Yeah.
Yeah.
10 years
house.
Old is when they start carrying a smartphone around. And that this, call it constant use, this constant dependency on it is, at least some researchers are saying, to back up your point, Pamela, it's changing the way our brains work.
Right. And there are some technical
terms for
it.
I don't know what I don't know.
It.
Do you know what I'm saying? And I'm too close to the forest to see the trees. I'm sure having a device in my hand that has all the information in the world on it has changed my thinking, has changed the way I do it. I'm just not sure how.
Right. And, you know, people used to say the same thing about like televisions, you know, the boom
tube. It's going to rot your brain.
It's going to rot your brain.
Right.
Right. And we go, well, we survived that and we're doing okay. But I would also offer you this. When you look at like Silicon Valley, where a lot of these startup companies and you have, you know, like Facebook and these massive tech companies are housed, you're seeing more and more of those parents coming out of that part of the country or heading up those types of corporations that are limiting their kids' screen time.
Yeah.
Some are even writing no screen clauses into the contracts with their nannies, which begs the question, what do they know that we don't know? Yet.
I think what they know that we don't know is that tech companies, and I don't mean to just pick on the Facebook or the Twitter, but they're kind of the big ones, and Instagram and these others. They know more about what makes you tick than you do. I'll use the term you can't see the forest for the trees. That the tech companies out there, those that are pushing content and stuff through a phone, let's just stick with phones for now, are experts in what it takes for you to open it up, to click on it, to swipe. And you probably don't even realize, and I'm going to say this nicely, how you're being manipulated. I acknowledge I don't understand how I'm being manipulated, but there's obviously something going on because I can't put the darn thing down.
So that's the difference between your traditional television set that we all grew up watching. I mean, it was a piece of furniture that we literally had to get up and change the channel on. What's different about that and what you currently have in your pocket, in your purse, or on your desk with you right now with your smartphone and all those apps are the developers of the most profitable and popular apps also have on their payroll sociologists. They have psychologists.
Yes.
They have people that are able to figure out how to manipulate you.
Thank you. That's
to
the word.
Use that app more and longer.
Snapchat, that's how they make money.
Snapchat, for instance. I don't have it, but
this
type of research definitely intrigues me because I do have a little girl in my house and her safety and security is of utmost importance to me. So I try to read up on these things. But Snapchat has a feature called like a streak, right? How many days you check in a row.
Absolutely. You get badges for it and things.
That in and of itself is part of the psychology of it. You have kids that are actually handing their phones or the login to their Snapchat so that when they go on vacation and mom and dad are taking their phones away, they don't lose their streak.
Right.
That's how they get you to engage. The TV never did that in the 80s.
No, there is exactly. What is fundamentally different about tech these days, as opposed to the TV when you were growing up, is that interactiveness. And I just get back to, if you think about it, think about it in your life. Is it a ringtone? Is it a chime maybe that goes off on your phone? Is it when it vibrates? Is it when you get the little pop-up message on the screen? It's become Pavlovian. And what I mean is, ring the bell, you salivate.
Or you stop at a red light and you pick up your phone.
I don't know many people who don't do it. The argument is, and these scientists are saying, we don't know how we're being manipulated. We can't possibly understand it because we're in the middle of being manipulated. That the people manipulating us are really, really smart at manipulating people. And we don't know the long-term effects of being constantly manipulated. Gee, other than that, everything's okay.
Right, and there are experiments that are going on right now, but they're going to take some time to get any fruit off from
them. I'm the experiment right now.
But one of the interesting things that they are studying right now is media multitasking. Media multitasking is using media while doing other media activities. So you're on your phone while you're watching TV.
Sure.
Or you are listening to music while doing homework or being on your phone while you're in a conversation. And what they have found so far in kids is those that have this like media multitasking have more sleep problems, have more attention problems, and are hurting them academically. So we're starting to see some of that research come out, but we're all just like guinea pigs in this massively huge experiment.
I'm going to make fun of those out there. Well, I'm not the one. And their phone goes ding, and they reach over and grab it real quick. Really? Really?
We all do
it. Work on you?
We all do it.
It works on you, without a doubt. Question. Honest question for some of you parents out there. Did you ever hold your kid back a year in school in order to gain a competitive advantage in sports? You want your kid to be bigger, faster, stronger? Are you one of these parents? It's happening. We're going to talk about it. And if you're brave enough, tell us about it. Tell us what you did. Our open mic line is 602-227-33. Did you hold your kid back? And when? Because some parents are doing it later and later. Oh, we're going to talk about this. It's coming up next on Arizona's News Station.
Get some perspective. Bruce St. James and Pamela Hughes. KTAR News on 92.3 FM.
Okay, so even though I don't have children, I remember discussions about, and I'm aware of people who have made the decision of when to enroll their child in school. Like kindergarten, first grade, right?
That's me.
based on the age of their child. Do you want your kid to be like the youngest in the class, or you want them to be the oldest in the class?
And a lot of that just depends on like the calendar year as to when the kid was born, because I found myself in that situation with Riley.
Give me an example. How does that work?
Her birthday is in August. Mm-hmm. So she could have either been the oldest kid in kindergarten.
Got it.
Or she could have been the youngest kid in kindergarten.
Got it.
All right? Because August is kind of one of those months where you're going to be on...
Either or.
Yeah.
Right on the
you're going to bookend it one way or the
Got
other.
Got it.
She's the oldest. That's what we decided was best for her.
And that was at what? Kindergarten?
Yeah. Kindergarten.
And I've heard of that. And that's probably not very unusual. But what if I told you that I'm not just going to blame this on the parents, that some kids today are redshirting, going back a year in order to gain a competitive advantage in sports in middle school?
It's called reclassing.
We used to call it failing the sixth grade.
No, it's called reclassing your fifth grader so that they'll have an edge in basketball and get recruited by a
really?
D1 school. Now,
you make them repeat the same grade?
Yeah. There's one mom who actually spoke about this, and most parents won't because of like the negative feedback that they
fear. I can imagine
right?
There's some negative feedback.
But this mom mm-hmm. says her name is Melanie, and she was approached about possibly having her kid repeat the fifth grade. We're talking middle school here.
Yeah.
Now, why would you voluntarily have your child who has excelled in the fifth grade repeat that fifth grade?
They didn't fail it.
Well, because it would up their chance of earning a college basketball scholarship.
Really? I'm sure this happens in other sports as well.
Well, basketball is where it seems to be the most prevalent.
Okay.
And the most acceptable, if it is accepted.
If it's even acceptable.
So Melanie was against it at first. She didn't want her kid to be teased for going through the same grade a second time, right?
Right.
Adjusting to a whole new set of friends. But she did it.
All new classmates, yeah. Think of it.
She did it. And she's glad she did.
Oh, why is that?
Because her son went on to become one of the top eighth grade basketball recruits in the D.C. area.
Uh-huh.
First off, I didn't realize that they were recruiting eighth graders.
Okay, oh, yes, they are.
This is a whole new world to me. He was a four-star college prospect at the high school with a scholarship offer from Stanford, Notre Dame, Virginia, and Georgetown.
So holding her kid back 1 year in the fifth grade.
Yep.
She believes translated. Now, there is an argument to be made her son would have progressed and been a good basketball player. But I can understand the argument that you give them another year to physically develop and develop their skills in basketball or any other sport, and they would have a competitive advantage.
Now, I don't know what the heck is going on in the D.C. area when it comes to basketball.
They're crazy about basketball in D.C.
Okay, because when you think about football, you think about like Texas,
Western
Pennsylvania.
Oh, no, D.C. is a basketball area.
Okay, so reclassing this red shirt and holding your kid back, they like calling it reclassing, is really common in the D.C. basketball scene. They estimate that about half of all D1 players going into basketball were reclassified in middle school.
So my question is, if it works for 1 year, would people do it for two?
What about three? Why stop at two?
I mean, are you going to have... your son is a hell of a basketball player. Well, he's a 22-year-old sophomore in high school. Like, well, hold on a second!
But I guess the other aspect to this, too, is, I mean, so this might be what mom and dad want. This might be what the kid wants. It may be what a future coach potentially wants. But when you go to a school... And the kid has passed the fifth grade. I mean, because right now, it's about 2 weeks before kids are being let out of school.
Right.
And you approach
what
the administrator.
What would you say to someone who's willing to...
You approach the administrator and you say, I want to hold Johnny back. And they go, why?
He's graduated. He's got a 3.2 GPA.
Well, because I want him to be better in basketball. If the school refuses, because I mean, do they have to hold them back? I guess I don't maybe understand how schools operate in that sense. Do you just take them to another school?
But it's basically making the argument in college that they're not there to go to school. They're there to play basketball. And you're bringing it down to the high school and junior high level. We're not really here to go to school. We're here to set ourselves up for basketball.
And you're also just assuming that the kid's going to improve and that this is going to up their chance.
What if they get worse?
Or it does nothing and you've held them back a year.
Being held back or failing a year was never a
good thing.
Nobody ever was proud of that.
Chime in on our open mic line, 602-200-2733. I'd love to hear what some parents have to say about this one.
So if I say the middle class, what does that mean to you? What do we mean when we say middle class? And how has it changed recently? The definition, the parameters of the middle class. We're talking about it next on Arizona's News Station.